The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
This episode deals with a man who perpetrated severe acts of domestic violence. But all domestic violence is extremely detrimental and dangerous. If you or anyone you know is experiencing domestic abuse and/or violence in any form, please stop this episode now and contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-SAFE. That's 800-799-7233. Many who have never experienced domestic violence, both physical and emotional abuse, often wonder why the victim doesn't simply leave the abuser, which is, without question, a form of victim blame that ignores the manipulation, fear, and danger that an abuser casts over their victims. There is a cycle in domestic violence that extends far beyond the individual acts of abuse themselves. Isolated incidents don't exist. Between severe and particularly violent incidents at the hands of an abuser are acts of methodical manipulation. The abuse becomes subtle and perhaps difficult for the victim to pinpoint. To avoid another explosive incident, a victim will likely tread lightly around the abuser, watching what they say or do, acting on their best behavior to avoid tense situations that might lead to a physically or emotionally violent outburst. When an event of abuse occurs, a quote, honeymoon phase will almost always follow, too. The abuser will become loving and affectionate, profusely apologetic, overly agreeable to the victim's wants and needs, and sometimes shower the victim with gifts. The behavior is nothing less than an act of control and manipulation by the abuser to keep the victim from leaving, and is an extension of the groundwork the abuser has already laid, that the victim has little choice but to stay, since no one else wants them. The cycle of abuse continues. But that's not necessarily why a victim of domestic violence and abuse stays. It's fear of leaving that is usually more prevalent. Perhaps the victim feels the uncertainty of their financial situation should they leave, not knowing how they'll provide themselves, and their children in some cases, with a roof and food. A victim might worry about the safety of family members, such as children or pets, beyond the fear of their own safety, fearing that the abuser will turn their anger elsewhere should they leave. According to the National Domestic Violence Hotline's website, the most dangerous time for the victim of domestic abuse, when that person's safety is most at risk, is when an attempt to leave is made. 75% of women who were murdered by an intimate partner, in fact, lost their lives when they left or attempted to leave the relationship. Violence at the hands of the abuser, who sees control slipping from their grasp, can be exacerbated tenfold. It is almost certainly what happened to Martha Maxwell when she disappeared from Watauga, Texas in 1992. On Wednesday, February 22, 2012, a towering, physically imposing man stood before a jury of 12 men and women. The man, 59-year-old Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, had been convicted of aggravated kidnapping and two counts of aggravated sexual assault the previous day. On March 1, 2011, Maxwell, a then resident of Corsicana, Texas, had returned to his old digs in Parker County and abducted an ex-neighbor, a 62-year-old woman. After striking up a conversation, Maxwell sprayed the woman in the face with some type of aerosol. He quickly grabbed her as she attempted to flee, shackled her ankles, and dragged her into her home. Inside, Maxwell bound her further using an electrical extension cord and struck her in the head twice with a blunt object. Still, the woman was able to break free of her bonds, bursting out the door of her home and fleeing down the desolate street in search of help. But before she could find that help, Maxwell caught up with her and at gunpoint ordered her to stop running, duct-taped her mouth, and put her into his vehicle. From there, Maxwell drove to his home about 100 miles away in Corsicana, Navarro County, just off the Richland Chambers Reservoir. For 12 days, Jeffrey Allen Maxwell sexually tortured and assaulted the 62-year-old devout Christian woman who questioned her worth to her God during the depraved acts inflicted upon her. She'd never been married, and because of her faith and devotion, the woman had never engaged in sexual activity. When Maxwell would sexually assault her, the woman later told the court at Maxwell's sentencing, she wondered if God could forgive her. 3 days after the abduction, Maxwell returned to the woman's home and burned it to the ground to destroy the evidence within, as she laid in a locked wooden coffin-like box back in Corsicana until he returned to further assault her. Parker County Sheriff's Office investigators, accompanied by Texas Rangers and Navarro County deputies, luckily, caught up to Maxwell on March 12, 2011, after neighbors of the woman reported seeing a vehicle that matched Maxwell's at the scene of the fire. When they visited his lake house, the 62-year-old woman, much to the surprise of officers who were questioning Maxwell on his porch, burst out the front door and into the safety that the present law enforcement provided. It's likely if the cops hadn't come, the woman would be dead. Nearly a year later, in February 2012, after he'd been convicted and after 50 minutes of deliberation, the jury had returned with sentencing. Jeffrey Allen Maxwell was given 3 life sentences, one for each count in which he was charged, with no parole eligibility for 30 years. It's likely he'll die in prison. There are a lot more details to Maxwell's heinous acts that led to his conviction, and some others. The man is responsible for far more terror than the acts he inflicted upon the 62-year-old woman who survived. We'll go into bits and pieces of them here, but Maxwell's crimes will be explored in depth on an upcoming Patreon-exclusive episode. However, it's Martha Martinez Maxwell, Jeffrey Allen Maxwell's second wife, and the unthinkable abuse she suffered at his hands, and her disappearance, that we'll concentrate this episode on. Though upon his arrest, Parker County Sheriff's deputies knew little of the totality of horror Maxwell had inflicted upon other women and children, detectives in Fort Worth were all too aware. They had tried to gather what they needed to charge Jeffrey Allen Maxwell with his second wife Martha's disappearance almost 20 years before his conviction. Upon the arrest of Jeffrey Allen Maxwell in 2011 for the abduction and sexual assault and torture of a 62-year-old Parker County, Texas woman, and upon reviewing the man's history, Texas Rangers began interviewing him. Maxwell was less than forthcoming, of course, and his direct evasion of questions such as, "Have you done anything that might have resulted in a past wife's death?" always resulted in the man asking to change the subject. He told interrogators that he'd used electrical shock devices on his ex-wife Martha, but she had consented to their use. Well, Maxwell said, at first she did. Martha, Rangers knew, had been missing since 1992. Born on November 15, 1951, in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, Martha Bertha Martinez met Jeffrey Allen Maxwell through a male matchmaking service in the early 1980s. Martha still lived in Mexico. She and Maxwell's courtship, besides a few trips he'd made over, was maintained and grew stronger through romantic letters between the two. The few times family members of Martha Martinez met Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, their impression of the man was less than satisfactory. They didn't like him. They found him, quote, creepy, and felt that the man was manipulating Martha's insecurities and lack of confidence. Though Martha's family pleaded with her not to marry Maxwell, she did on December 24, 1981, across the border from her Juarez home in El Paso, Texas. The 29-year-old woman thought she'd fallen in love with the man and insisted that Maxwell was the only chance she had at becoming a wife and a mother. In 1982, Martha and Maxwell had a son together. It was her first child and Maxwell's third. He'd married his girlfriend, Rita, in 1971 when he was 18 after she became pregnant. They divorced in 1979 after having another child. Martha and Jeffrey Maxwell moved to a suburb called Watauga, which sits about 10 miles from downtown Fort Worth's center. Friends and family already worried for Martha. They knew something just wasn't right about Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, and it wasn't long after she married Maxwell that those feelings were realized and even amplified. She began telling friends about Maxwell's, quote, troubling behavior. When Martha asked her husband to accompany her to her sister's wedding, Maxwell approached the bride after the ceremony and made the remark that since they were family now, he could kiss her. And that's just what he did, forcing his tongue into her mouth. At the wedding of another of Martha's family members, he did that very same thing again. Though she hid Maxwell's troubling behavior she'd told friends about, the bruising to Martha's wrists and ankles, as if she'd been shackled, were much more difficult to hide. But those signs were nothing compared to the horror Martha later faced, the full extent of which will likely never be known. On Sunday, April 19, 1987, police in Watauga, Texas, got a call from a Carter County, Oklahoma sheriff's deputy. The Oklahoma deputy told Watauga authorities that they found a woman there on foot off Interstate 35, 10 miles north of Ardmore, early that morning. The woman had been quickly transported to Dallas's Parkland Hospital because her injuries were so severe, and since that facility was the closest Level 1 trauma hospital at the time, the highest designation of care as far as expertise and resources for trauma patients. The woman had been beaten far beyond what could be considered badly and was bound with duct tape. She was barely clinging to life when Carter County, Oklahoma deputies found her, having lost an incredible amount of blood from the ear-to-ear slit across her throat. The woman was Martha Maxwell of Watauga, Texas. Watauga officers immediately visited Martha and Jeffrey Maxwell's home. They found Maxwell there and asked him when the last time he saw his wife was. He told them he hadn't seen her since the previous night at about 10 p.m. When an officer told Maxwell she was found severely injured but still alive, the man acted surprised. Doctors at Parkland, meanwhile, were hard at work making sure Martha Maxwell didn't die, and their diligent efforts were a success. Martha survived the horrific and savage attack against her, an attack that was, no doubt, an attempted slaying. She began trying to recollect the events to police. The night before she was found, Martha told them, she and Maxwell had gotten into an argument. He beat her, and after falling asleep on the sofa, Martha awoke to find that she'd been bound with duct tape, her hands behind her back, and a piece over her mouth. In the couple's bedroom, Jeffrey Allen Maxwell sexually tortured Martha, attaching a device to her nipples that delivered an electric shock, before forcing her to drink a mixture of liquor, sleeping pills, and pain reliever. After that, Martha said, she remembered nothing until waking up in Parkland Hospital's trauma unit. She filed charges against Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, her husband. Watauga detectives searched Martha and Maxwell's home and collected a bag of relatively harmless items that might be found in the home of anyone who practices BDSM or bondage, dominance, sadism, and masochism. The bag had clothespins, cords, and handcuffs, but no electrical shocking device, blood, or the knife used to slit Martha's throat. Another bag was found with books about bondage, one about the bondage of wives and one in which the title referred to, quote, caged schoolgirls. Police only took photographs of the books, and what they found in the house anyway wasn't nearly the smoking gun evidence they sought or expected to find. Martha and Maxwell's 1986 Toyota was also searched, the vehicle they believed the man used to transport and dump her outside Ardmore, Oklahoma. Nothing of significance, however, was found in the car. Regardless, police arrested Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, charging him with aggravated kidnapping. What happened next is, perhaps, one of the best examples of the power a domestic abuser, masters of manipulation, can have over their victims, even from behind bars. Martha Maxwell stopped talking with police completely just before she was to testify at the indictment proceedings in July of 1987, later telling friends and family that she felt as if authorities didn't believe her. Without her testimony, the key piece of the case against Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, a Tarrant County grand jury declined to indict the man. Maxwell was off the hook for his heinous actions, but that's not the end of that. In fact, it's the intermediate point of the story. But it's a point that, if it had played out differently, if Martha would have chosen a different action, it might have been the end, with nothing else to report. Although the district attorney had been seeking a kidnapping charge against Maxwell, what he did to Martha was nothing short of attempted murder. The kidnapping case, however, was likely easier to prove at that point, and in Texas, being convicted of such an offense can land a life sentence. Martha had even left Texas in fear of the man, taking her son back to Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, to stay with family. But Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, ever the manipulator, the violent control freak, began sending Martha letters there. In the correspondence, Maxwell profusely apologized for what he'd done and told Martha he needed her back. God wanted them together, he told her, knowing how to manipulate her heavy Catholic roots. Though exactly what the letters said isn't entirely clear, the language and agenda of them, her sister later said, was wrought with gaslighting, or Maxwell placing the blame for what he'd done on Martha's shoulders. As she began relenting to Maxwell's manipulation, Martha's family begged her not to return to him, but she did. Just months after dropping the charges against her husband, Martha Martinez Maxwell was back in Fort Worth living with her husband, Jeffrey Allen Maxwell. For a few years, things between Martha Martinez Maxwell and her husband, Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, appeared to be going okay. He'd allowed her to go to college and obtain an associate's degree, and they'd bought a house in the same suburb city of Fort Worth they used to live, Watauga, Texas, in 1991. From the outside looking in, the man who'd left Martha 100 miles from her Texas home, outside of Ardmore, Oklahoma, drugged, savagely beaten, and bleeding from her slashed neck, had turned a new leaf and was making things right. But, like most abusers, attempted murderers, Maxwell had manufactured and manipulated this new life, the calm before the storm. Though Martha had fallen back in with the man, her family, of course, wasn't buying Maxwell's bullshit. And it wasn't just them. Neighbors of the couple at their new Watauga home, folks who knew nothing about Maxwell's depraved attack against his wife, didn't like the man either. They called him perverted and said that Maxwell was, quote, a bully, likely describing the way he treated Martha and presumably the couple's son, who was approaching 10 years old. Since she'd reconciled with Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, Martha kept in touch with her family in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, most often by phone, but she regularly visited her parents and siblings too. On Sunday, May 10, 1992, Mother's Day, two of Martha's family members each received a letter from her, or at least letters that appeared to be written by her. Her sister immediately thought the method of correspondence was strange and unlike her. She'd always just pick up the phone and call when she wanted to talk or had something to tell them. The few times Martha did send letters, she wrote in her first language, Spanish, but those letters were written in English. The envelopes, too, had been addressed in a different hand than the letters themselves. The subject of the correspondence was to the point. Martha, the letters said, was leaving Jeffrey Allen Maxwell and their son, and she didn't plan on being in touch with anyone for quite some time. Martha's family and friends were disturbed by the letters, and though they always knew that nothing good could possibly come from Martha getting back with Maxwell, intense worry for her safety hit them hard. Martha's brother phoned Jeffrey Allen Maxwell and asked where his sister was. Maxwell told him she left and abruptly hung up. He knew immediately, Martha's brother later said, that Maxwell had done something terrible to his sister. Martha's sister, too, had absolutely no doubt that the man had harmed her. Both friends and family contacted the Fort Worth police, who did little to get things moving to try and locate Martha. Martha's brother had to physically travel to Fort Worth from Mexico, in fact, for an official report to be filed. The missing persons report officially declared Martha Martinez Maxwell as having disappeared the same day her family received the letters, on Sunday, May 10, 1992. The 41-year-old Hispanic female with black hair and brown eyes was classified as an endangered missing person. Fort Worth police got serious about Martha's disappearance immediately upon learning of Jeffrey Allen Maxwell's past abuse and his attempted murder of the woman. But Maxwell, of course, wasn't talking. She abandoned the family, the man said, and that was, quote, her tough luck. But Martha didn't take her vehicle, credit cards, social security card, or her son, which was, to put it mildly, suspicious. Not only did she have no money and no transportation, it was a ridiculous notion that the loving and doting mother would have left her boy behind. Detectives knew Maxwell was responsible, but were unable to gather any evidence against him. He was law enforcement's only suspect in Martha's disappearance, but the man had covered his tracks well, and investigators couldn't find so much as an indication of what he'd done to her. The investigation was short-lived and went nowhere, and the disappearance of Martha Martinez Maxwell went cold fast. Martha had confided in her brother before she vanished, telling him of the abuse she suffered at the hands of Jeffrey Allen Maxwell. Despite the abuse, Martha told him, she wouldn't leave, because she feared he would take her son away from her, or worse, harm him. Martha's brother stewed with rage for years after she disappeared, blaming himself for not doing something, anything, to prevent what he knows happened to her. By the time Maxwell was finally brought to justice, though only for a small portion of his depraved crimes, he and Martha's son was nearing 30. Martha's family had long lost touch with him, but after his father's arrest in 2011, Martha's son reached out to them, asking what they believed happened to his mother, and he wanted it straight. Before and even since the arrest, Maxwell had denied to his son any involvement in Martha's disappearance. But upon learning of what his dad had done to the 62-year-old Parker County woman, having attended only the first day of his trial, Martha's son needed more than ever to know the truth. Though Jeffrey Allen Maxwell has yet to come clean with that truth, he and Martha's son would learn far more than he ever could have imagined about the heinous acts in which his father was implicated in. A couple years after Martha Martinez Maxwell vanished, Jeffrey Allen Maxwell filed for divorce. He cited in the paperwork that Martha abandoned he and his son, and also cited a, quote, conflict of personalities. A notice of divorce was published, and an attempt at locating Martha to serve her papers was made, but she never materialized. Jeffrey Allen Maxwell was granted the divorce in February of 1995. Not long after the divorce was final, Maxwell remarried his first wife, Rita, and she and her three daughters from another marriage moved in with him. The marriage dissolved over time when his underage stepdaughters repeatedly accused him of sexually assaulting them. Sexual molestation is what the press refers to it as. And even Rita's best friend came forward, telling Rita that Maxwell had raped her. Like Martha Martinez Maxwell, Rita was presumably the victim of abuse by Jeffrey Allen Maxwell, since she later left the state of Texas entirely, getting her and her daughters as far away from him as she possibly could. She even changed her name. Rita's daughter and her best friend all testified at Maxwell's 2012 trial, telling jurors of the sexual assault. After his 2011 arrest, Jeffrey Allen Maxwell became a suspect in other area mysteries, a Weatherford missing persons case, and a Mineral Wells homicide. At about 10 p.m. on Tuesday, February 1st, 2000, 51-year-old Amelia Smith left her job at Yellow Cab Company in Irving, Texas, and headed home to Weatherford. Since her husband was staying at his mother's that night, and their children at Amelia's brother's, she was coming home to an empty house. Amelia's trailer home was located off Farm to Market Road 730 in far northeast Weatherford. Several hours after she presumably made it home, at 4 a.m. on February 2nd, 9/11 dispatch got a call about a fire. It was Amelia's home. When emergency responders arrived, the mobile home was entirely engulfed in flames. After the fire was under control, which fire investigators determined was an arson, it was discovered that an attempt to set Amelia's car ablaze, too, had been made. The 51-year-old woman's body was not found in what remained of the burnt home. Though extensive searches for Amelia Smith were performed, some using trained dogs, clues as to what happened to her were never found. Amelia, a white female with brown hair and brown eyes, who stands 5 feet 3 inches tall and weighs 111 pounds, was never seen nor heard from again. Since no evidence of what happened to Amelia could be collected, the case went cold all but immediately. She was classified by authorities as an endangered missing person. Over a decade later, when Jeffrey Allen Maxwell was arrested, Parker County investigators' interest in Amelia Smith's case was heavily renewed, and her family, too, became hopeful for answers. The circumstances behind Amelia's disappearance bore some striking resemblances to the 62-year-old woman's disappearance who had survived Maxwell's cruel and evil acts. The homes both burned down, with evidence of the use of accelerants. The fact that whoever burned the mobile home also attempted to set Amelia's car on fire, and the car of the 62-year-old survivor of Maxwell had been set afire. And they were both older women, and both deeply religious. Though Amelia's family couldn't connect her to Jeffrey Allen Maxwell in any way, it's thought she didn't know him at all like the survivor did, they still hoped he'd come clean and give them resolution. Maxwell, however, never did, though he remains a person of interest in Amelia Smith's disappearance. Police in Mineral Wells, Texas, also had Maxwell in mind for a homicide in their jurisdiction. Krishanda Townsend lived outside of Perrin, Texas, in Jack County, in Gibb Town. The young and proud mother of a 2-year-old son was a devout Christian whose happy and spirited demeanor matched her age. She was 19 years old. In the early morning hours of Sunday, July 5th, 2010, at 12:10 a.m., Krishanda sent her mother a text message telling her she was on her way home. She'd spent the July 4th holiday with friends in Mineral Wells, about 24 miles away from where she lived with family. Krishanda never made it back home and was reported missing quickly, within just a couple hours. Luckily, police took the disappearance seriously and issued a be on the lookout for the young woman's vehicle immediately. That vehicle, a gray 1997 Toyota sedan, was found parked on the 800 block of Southeast 3rd Avenue in Mineral Wells about 4 hours after Krishanda was last seen. The car's radio had been removed, though the individual who'd stolen it was later determined to have not been involved in the woman's disappearance. He'd simply happened upon the car parked there and ransacked and burglarized it. Keys to the car were found discarded in a lot adjacent to where the vehicle was parked a few days later. Krishanda's cell phone was determined to have been on until about 2 a.m. Multiple searches of Mineral Wells and the surrounding areas in the following days, weeks, and months provided no clues as to Krishanda Townsend's whereabouts. The young mother vanished without so much of a trace. The disappearance had gone completely cold until on Thursday, October 27th, 2011, almost a year and a half later, when her remains were found. That day, a prospective buyer of property inspected a field just outside the southwesternmost border of Mineral Wells. About 30 yards off the road, in a ravine, the prospective property owner spotted a human skull. Authorities were immediately alerted. The remains were sent to the University of North Texas in Denton, where forensic anthropologist Dr. Harold Gill King later matched the teeth of the skull and mandible to the dental records of Krishanda Townsend. Where Krishanda's remains were found was just a few miles from the last place the mother was confirmed to have last been seen, an Easy Mart convenience store that was close to the friend's house she'd been visiting that Independence Day in 2010. Mineral Wells police believed, at least during the initial investigation, that whoever abducted and killed Krishanda was familiar with Mineral Wells, but a $20,000 reward offered for information provided no substantial leads. The 2011 arrest of Jeffrey Allen Maxwell led to Mineral Wells detectives questioning the man about the murder of Krishanda Townsend, though what, if anything, they ascertained from the interviews has not been expounded upon publicly, nor has the precise reason they suspect Maxwell. It's likely if Maxwell was involved in her murder or the disappearance of Amelia Smith in Weatherford, he hasn't confessed to or even hinted to his involvement in the crimes. Maxwell continues to deny that he has any knowledge of Martha Martinez Maxwell's disappearance, his second wife who he abused and once left for dead on the side of an Oklahoma highway, and he remains incarcerated at the Texas Department of Corrections Estelle Unit in Huntsville. Again, if you or anyone you know is experiencing domestic abuse and/or violence, please contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-SAFE. That's 800-799-7233. Please don't wait until it's too late. If you have any information about the disappearance of Martha Martinez Maxwell, or Amelia Smith, or the murder of Krishanda Townsend, please contact the Texas Rangers through their cold case website, dps.texas.gov/texasrangers/unsolved homicides, or by calling 800-346-3243. Also, if you'd like to help find answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or perhaps identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit dnasolves.com where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company like Ancestry or 23andMe to their database. We'll provide a link in the show notes. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as The Devil of West Texas, about serial killer Michael Eugene Sharp, among others. I'll have the exclusive episode further detailing the heinous crimes of Jeffrey Allen Maxwell up at Patreon as soon as possible, too. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. Without your help, we couldn't do what we do, and it means the world to us. The Corsicana Daily Sun, the Dallas Morning News, the Weatherford Democrat, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, D Magazine, WomenAgainstCrime.com, YourStephenville.com, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.